Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
There's my main man. Watch your step. See, this Florida makes, I'm telling you, I got to get to Florida, man. Luke Pinello's here. Look at this. It's like a reunion. Good to see you, Luke. Craig, pleasure. How are you? Come on in. This is like an old school reunion. Well, two guys that made their bones on a members-only commercial back in 1984. Oh,
we were in Cincinnati the same time together. They had the Nasty Boys for
Lou,
the Reds.
Lou, Boomer, and Craig, thanks for coming.
Thanks,
in.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I remember that members commercial, only? Members only. Yeah, yes. I had a lot of those jackets for a long time.
You and me both. You, me, Vince Van Patten, Buck Williams, and, of course, the great Payne Stewart.
Exactly.
Was also in that. And there might have been one other guy in that. I can't remember who it was.
I'd have to double to go back and take a look at it.
Well, you got
to
get great memory. Yeah, I remember you because we were together in Cincinnati. We actually shot a few photos together.
Yes, we did. So you had the Nasty Boys and Norm Charlton and Rob Dibble and all those guys. Eric Davis, you won the 1990 World Series.
Exactly.
And I remember going to one of those Worlds. I think I went to one of those World Series games. And Sam Weish was like, he can't go to the game. And I'm like, I'm going to the game. So I caught a little hell from my head coach. But, yeah, we had a lot of run-ins.
Well, you've lived some life in baseball, Lou, from being an 18-year-old kid going to play through all the managerial stuff. So I'm not sure the best place to begin. So let me go in no particular order. I'll go backwards. When it all ended, regrets of how your managerial career ended, or do you leave it on the table and have no regrets at all about
the
your managerial?
The only regret that I had is I never finished my last season. I went home last week of August.
Right.
My mom was really, really, really sick, and I kept getting calls from my aunt telling me, you got to come home. We weren't going anywhere that year.
Right.
So I talked to the general manager and ownership, and they allowed me to go home. And I'm really thankful because they paid me the rest of the year.
They didn't have to.
Right? Yeah, nice people. Nice
so
people
there
in Chicago. Yeah, the Cub organization's a really, really nice organization. The Ricketts family that runs it, the general manager I had, Jim Henry, good people. They really were good people to work for.
What was it like having played for the Yankees and then having the short stint being the Yankee manager?
That was with George, right?
I wonder, like, when in the moment, I would think your ego has to take over a little bit, and you're livid about how things go down. 20 years later, you've probably reconciled, and it is what it is.
Yeah, it was reconciled when I left. Look, I've always been extremely thankful to Mr. Steinbrenner for giving me an opportunity. I retired the middle of the 84 season. And in 86, I'm managing the New York Yankees. I mean, that just doesn't happen.
Right.
I never managed a game in the minor leagues. I never managed a game in winter league or anything else. Mr. Steinbrenner gave me that opportunity. And I had a special relationship with him. And I saw what went on with a few of the other managers, and I said, that'll never happen
Billy
to
Martin,
me.
Billy Martin, in particular, yes.
I'll be here forever. This will be great.
Yeah, but, he was tough. He was tough to work for. He taught me a lot, though, look, if it hadn't been for him, I'd have probably never embarked on a managing career because at that time, I probably would have never gone down to the minor leagues to manage. I'd have probably never gone to winter league to manage. He gave me that opportunity. But, boy, I'll tell you what, it wasn't easy for the 3 years I was there.
Well, when you take a look at your career, I mean, you are literally baseball royalty. I mean, it's the Yankees. It's the Cubs. It's the tenure that you had out there with A-Rod in Seattle, winning 116 games.
Ken
Griffey Jr., of course. And then going back to the Tampa Bay Rays. And, I mean, just so many things that you did. The book is going to be great. I think it's going to be great. Hopefully it captures every aspect of it. I would imagine
it will.
Right?
Yeah, we talk about all these things, a lot of the funny things that happened during my career, the great years I spent with the Yankees, with Thurman and Bobby Mercer and Catfish Hunter and Guidry and Bucky Dent and Reggie and the rest of these guys. I was fortunate. I managed many, many great players. We can start here in New York with with the Winfield and the Ricky Hendersons.
It's
we can
amazing.
Go to Cincinnati with Barry Larkin and Eric Davis and Paul O'Neill. Then we can go on to Seattle with Alex and Junior. Junior was the best player I ever managed.
I
mean, this guy here for 6 years was just the best player in baseball. There's nothing he could do. He had some injuries, and when he went to Cincinnati, Boomer, he was towards the tail end of his career. But, boy, I saw him. I saw him at his best.
You managed two of the purest talents in the history of baseball, and Alex Rodriguez and Ken Griffey Jr. I think you were very close with Alex, at least early on in his career.
Brought him up as an 18-year-old kid.
And you had him up until, I think, 94. I wondered, as a baseball guy, knowing that just pure raw talent, you coached two of the best, maybe of all time. When Alex decided to go down the road he went, did you ever counsel him or talk to him? And I would think that had hurt you to your core somewhat.
It did.
A guy like that did what he did.
It did bother me a lot. It really did. You know, the amazing thing is I managed when I played. Steroids weren't part of the clubhouse. If there were steroids in my era, it had to be very, 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 very minute. But I guess when he went to Texas, things changed, and I talked to him. But again, I was managing another different team.
Right.
When I really did talk to him more was towards the end of the episode when. He was in problems with the union and suing baseball and
right,
so forth.
And the Yankees and all this other stuff.
And I told him, I said, that's not the way to go.
He seems like he's done a really good job rebuilding who he is.
No question.
Fox.
He's a wonderful young man.
He is a good guy.
He's a wonderful young man.
Who just got involved in stuff that he
couldn't
get out
of. No question. You know what? Everybody makes mistakes in life. And for the most part, athletes, I think Boomer can attest to this, they like the edge somehow, if they can get it.
Yeah, everybody's looking for that edge. You know, I know that they do it, head coaches in football do it. Bill Belichick does it, and has done it for a long time. Everybody's looking for that little thing that's going to give you the edge over the other players. But I also, you know, Alex was 18 years old. And he was a can't-miss prospect, much like Ken Griffey Jr. They did not go to college.
No.
They went thrust right into the men's world. And Alex had a lot of, I want to say bad people, just the wrong people hanging around
him. I think so, Boomer. I agree with you totally. I mean, you know, you can get steered in the wrong direction. And that's exactly what happened with him. But, you know, I talked to him about a year ago in Chicago. In fact, yesterday we had a little book signing in downtown Manhattan at Barnes & Noble, and he came by, but I was gone already. I wish I had
That's
seen
great.
Him. But, you know,
well,
I talked to him
it.
From
he
time to
gets
time.
It, right? He gets it.
He gets it. He gets it. He's at peace with himself. He's dating J-Lo. Nothing wrong with that. So I'm happy for him. I really am. He had a great career.
To Lou Piniella, it's kind of interesting. They just obviously retired Derek Jeter's number on Sunday. Did you watch any of that?
I watched it on TV. I thought it was a wonderful and very fitting. You know, this guy was a player. He really was. I see him actually in Tampa all the time at the golf course where we play at Avila. And I can tell you this, though. His golf swing is not nearly as good as his baseball
swing.
Right. I can tell you that.
More normal
but yeah, listen, when I managed against the Yankees, I didn't like Jeter. He beat me. I mean, I just didn't like it. When I managed, I wanted to compete and win. And Derek always had a hand in whether it was a great play at shortstop, whether it was stealing a base, whether it's hitting a ball in the gap, whether it's walking. I mean, this guy here was a player, complete player. One team, New York Yankees.
That's right. Right? 20 years.
I mentioned the name of the book is Lou, 50 Years of Kicking Dirt, Playing Hard, and Winning Big in the Sweet Spot of Baseball. Bill Madden wrote it with Lou Piniella, who's kind enough to join us here this morning. I want to go back a long way away into your playing career. And you brought up the name Thurman Munson. Now, I remember I was, 7, 8 years old when we learned about, you know, the terrible crash.
Terrible. I was 1979.
Up at Kutcher Sports Academy playing in a tournament up there. And everyone it was like, oh, my God, Thurman Munson. Where were you when you heard the news?
I was home in Allendale. I was home in Allendale. In fact, we were having a little. It's my wife's birthday, August 2nd. Mm. So we were having a little birthday party in my backyard in Allendale, New Jersey, swimming party. And all of a sudden, the phone rings, and it's Mr. Steinbrenner, and he's hysterical on the phone, and he's telling me what had happened. I just couldn't believe it that Thurman had passed away in Canton, Ohio, doing touch-and-goes at the airport. And I was mad at Thurman. I really was, because we had talked to him, Boomer and Carton. We had talked to him about the fact, hey, listen, I used to fly with Thurman on his prop jets. He had a Beechcraft Baron, and he had another plane. And I used to fly with him. But when I saw this citation, I mean, this thing here looked it looked like a bullet. I mean, and I told him, I said, gosh, I said, Thurman, you don't really need this. I mean, these other planes, fine, but this is a little bit much. And we spent the last night that I saw him in Chicago at Bobby Mercer's apartment, and we talked till 3 or 4 in the morning. And we had talked a lot about
getting rid of the plane.
Yeah, and then the next day there's a day off, or 2 days later, I'm sorry. We had the game on Sunday,
right?
And then on Monday it's a day off, and this happens. But what a great guy! I mean, look, this guy would have been a Hall of Famer if he wanted to manage in the big leagues. He would have been an excellent manager. He was a baseball guy, tough as nails, and a big, big heart.
Talking to Lou Piniella, just reminiscing a little bit about Yankee career and managing. I was always mad at you after 1990. The first time I ever placed a wager on a baseball game was the 1990 World Series.
That was a cinch for Oakland, right?
I mean, Oakland was locked
you
and loaded.
You can't bet cinches.
Bash Brothers, Stu, they had everybody.
Yeah.
And I remember, I go, all right, so I'll put $100 on the A's.
Yeah.
You take game one.
And you had a great manager over there, Tony La Russa, that I grew up with in Tampa.
They're not losing two in a row. Bang, you're down two bills. Well, listen, the Oakland A's, they're going to come back and take game three. They have to do that. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't know if it was game two or three, you went 10 innings in one of those games.
The first game.
Was it game one?
Yeah, game one. That set the tone. It set the tone. It really did. You know, the reason I felt that we could beat Oakland, I mean this sincerely, first of all, we played a wonderful, wonderful playoff game against the Pirates. That was well-played baseball. So we were at the top of our game. At the same time, Oakland's pitching staff, they had two or three 20-game winners on that staff.
Dave Stewart was on that team, right?
Bob Welsh, forget who else. But let me tell you what, they threw fastballs. Our kids in Cincinnati could hit the fastball.
Chris Sabo on that team?
Sabo was on that team.
Larkin.
We had Eric Davis. We had O'Neill. Billy Hatcher, Hal Morris.
So you weren't worried about their pitchers?
No, I thought we could score some runs on them. And at the same time, we threw as much velocity as we could. And the only pitcher, basically, that didn't throw all that hard on our staff was Tom Browning, but he could really, really pitch. But once we got to the sixth inning, I had those three animals in the bullpen.
Yeah, the Nasty Boys.
Boys, and Dibble, and Myers, and Charlton, and these kids
came
all
over.
Threw. Dibble threw the hardest at 100, and when he was getting his slider over, he was impossible to hit.
I think Jeff Ruby spent a lot of time throwing those guys out of the waterfront, you know, that
I
year.
I think so.
That's one of the reasons why you guys went all the way on to win the World Series.
Right,
there's
right.
no question about that. But, I think about the trade of Paul O'Neill to the Yankees. I mean, when that happened and you saw this happening, I mean, what was your initial thought?
Actually, I was managing in Seattle then, and Gene Michael, the general manager, called me. Uh-huh. Gene Michael is the general manager of the Yankees. Yeah. And he asked me, he said, look, I have an opportunity to get O'Neill for Roberto Kelly. I said, what are you waiting for? I said, O'Neill is a player, you know? And to his credit, he made that deal. And then later on, the same thing. We end up giving the Yankees, when I was in Seattle, Tino Martinez. Mm-hmm. And then they're kicking my butt in the playoffs every year.
And we can't get by them.
Two great pieces, though, to add to your team, Tino Martinez and Paul
O'Neill. Oh, wonderful. You know, left-hand hitting is extremely important to win at the big league level.
But also character guys, though.
Wonderful
really
guys.
High character guys.
Wonderful guys.
Guys that were going to give you everything they had.
You know, Steinbrenner, when we traded Tino to the Yankees, he called me. I was living in Tampa, and he was too. And
right.
He said, look, I need to talk to you. You're not trying to flim-flam me. I said, flim-flam you in what way? He says, Manley had a great career here, and he's hard to replace. Can Tino handle? Is he tough enough?
He made that phone
And
call.
I said, yeah, he is. But I told him, I said, you know, you guys got some good minor league talent there that we're going to want for him. And I mentioned Andy Pettit and Posada, yeah. and we didn't get either of them.
Talking to Lou Piniella, the book is called Lou. It's available for now on Amazon and in all your favorite bookstores. You know, you bring up George Steinbrenner, who is instrumental, I think, in your life, not just your career. You know, a lot of guys that we've talked to who played for the Yankees or worked for the Yankees describe a man a lot different than the public persona. Not that he wasn't both. Without being disrespectful to his memory, but in telling some stories about what was George Steinbrenner like behind closed doors for you?
Look, he had a wonderful personality. He really did. If you went out to dinner with him, you could have fun with him. You could kid around with him. But I'll tell you what, I remember when I first started managing for him, just to give you an example, he said, look, your job is to win a World Series, number one and foremost. But number two, your job is to help put fannies in the seat. So he says, when you get kicked out of ball games, put on a show. Baseball's a business. It's a sport, but it's also entertainment. He understood that as well. Yeah, he understood that as well as anybody.
Harder to work for him or Marge Schott and Shotzi the dog?
Oh, my gosh. No, it was different, though. It was harder to work for George. George basically was tough, you know. And the amazing thing about it, he had a little bit of a sports background. He thought he knew baseball. I remember one time he calls me and he says, Lou, he says, you're killing me. He says, you're killing me. I said, what's wrong, Mr. Steinbrenner? And he says, look, when you go out to the mound, he says, and you want to pull the pitcher, he says, leave him in. And when you want to leave him in, pull him out. He says, everything you do is wrong. And he clicked me.
That's crazy. Talking to Lou Piniella. So when he fires you, did he do it face-to-face?
Oh, no, he did it face-to-face. He made me fly all the way to Tampa. And I told him, I said, do it over the phone. I said, you know, I don't feel like flying down there. But he says, no, you're coming down. So I flew down, and his driver picks me up at the airport, takes me in to see him. And my wife, which she really liked Mr. Steinbrenner. In fact, George bought my wife her first fur coat. She never forgets that, right? So anyway, she's going to give him a piece of his mind, of her mind, if he's going to fire me. And I said, look, I said, he's going to fire me. I know this. And he steps out of his office when he sees I'm in the lobby, and he sees her, and he ducks back in, and he gets his secretary, Joanne. He says, here's $500. Take Anita shopping. But anyway, he did. He called me in, and we sat and talked for a while, and he said, look, I'm going to let you go. And I said, I appreciate it.
How did that go? I mean, it's got to make you feel like – it's got to give you a sinking feeling, right? I mean, here's George Steinbrenner, who gave you your first chance, now is actually taking that away from you.
Yeah. Listen, I did. I felt bad about it. But at the same time, boy, I tell you what, it got a little rough.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah, it got a little rough, the phone calls and, But look.
Was it a relief? Let me ask you.
It was a relief. That's what I mean. It was a relief. But the amazing thing about it is he tells me, all right, let's talk about the team. I said, talk about the team. I said, talk to about the team of your next manager. Don't talk to me.
Right. But at least
he said, well, do you want to know who it is? And I said, not really, but I wish him well. And he said, no, it's Dallas Green. I said, oh, boy, I'm thinking to myself, Dallas is hard-headed, and he doesn't, you know, he's tough, too. And,
right.
And I said, oh, I'm wondering how that's going to work out. But anyway, I'm ready to leave, and I thank him. And he goes to the door, and he says, you're not leaving. You're not leaving. I said, what? And he said, you're going to sign an extension. Yeah. So I signed a 3-year extension. He fired me.
Right.
But I signed a 3-year extension for a lot more money than I was making. And now, but it was a personal service. It wasn't a major league contract.
Right.
It was a personal service that I worked for he and the Yankees. So I go outside, and my wife said, well, what'd you do? He said, well, he fired me. Well, I'm going to talk to him. I said, no, we got a lot of money, 3-year extension. Let's get the hell out of here.
Now you are personal services. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable. Look, I love the guy. I really did. I really did. But I hated him at times.
Right.
I actually hated him at times. He was tough.
That's an amazing story, though. So at the end of the day, he had his thoughts about baseball, but he took care of you personally.
He did. And, you know, I think probably if I had stayed around in the organization, you know, I was Billy 3, Billy 4, Billy 5. Lou 6.
You're right. We're talking to the great Lou Piniella. I mean, I make fun of it, but for people in Cincinnati – Marge Schott was bigger than life.
No question.
And that was your next owner that you started work. So you go from George Steinbrenner to Marge Schott.
Yes.
And Marge Schott used to bring her St. Bernard, Schottsy, to the games.
She had four of them.
She had four
Schottsys.
I remember as a fan watching that.
So I'm just trying to think what those conversations were like after games.
Well, the first one was when I went over there, she asked me about managing the Reds, and I told her I would be very interested. And she says, I told her, I said, but you got to convince George, because the year before, Pat Gillick tried to hire me in Toronto, and George wouldn't let me go because he had me in a personal service contract,
right,
and it was in the same division. But Cincinnati, being in the National League, et cetera, she says, oh, honey, I know George really well. I'll get you this job if you want it. So she did. She convinced George to let me go. But now she calls me and she says, you know, he's paying you a little bit too much money. You're going to have to take a pay cut to manage the Reds.
Oh, go man. Figure. Lou Piniella, check out the book, 50 Years of Kicking Dirt, Playing Hard, and Winning Big in the Sweet Spot of Baseball. Can you ever match the feeling of 45,000 New Yorkers chanting your first name?
Well, it's unbelievable. You know what? The good thing with Lou is they can boo you or loo you. They all sound right. The same.
You,
really, it's the truth.
But
it was wonderful
connection.
Playing here in New York. And, you know, when I got traded here in 73, I actually cried.
Yeah.
You know, we were living in Kansas City. It's a small market team. It was a close-knit team, et cetera, et cetera. But it was the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me in my career. Playing in New York, playing with
winning
the Pinstripes, winning some World Series.
Right.
Great players. Getting a chance to manage. I mean, I've been so fortunate in baseball, and I thank all the people that gave me the opportunity to work, the general managers I work with, and the players that played for me. I mean, I'm sure not all of them liked me.
Right.
Sure, that's part of the job.
You know, when Reggie Jackson is doing what he did in the World Series, that had to be just for a guy, you know, sitting in the dugout watching that display with, you know, the three consecutive home runs.
Yeah.
That had to be unreal being on that team and watching what he did.
Look, Reggie could perform. You know, at times he was a little bit of a pain, but
right.
Let me tell you what: when in the limelight, he liked it. He wanted to be the guy to get it done. And that particular series, I mean, he just took over the series. I remember he had three home runs, one further than the other,
right,
and off three different type pitchers: fastball pitcher, a knuckleball pitcher, and a breaking ball pitcher. It was a show. You don't see that in postseason. I mean, you're facing really good pitching in the Dodgers. Had good pitching, and Reggie performed.
And that's exactly what George Steinbrenner wanted. He wanted that type of show. That was like...
That's what he wanted,
that
Boomer.
Was back in the days of Studio 54, Lou.
That's what he wanted. But, you know, he understood free agency better than anybody else in his infancy. He signed the top people, the Catfishes, the Reggies.
He wanted stars.
He wanted stars. And you know what? He was right. And now what happened was he had so much success with free agency early on that now... Everybody started paying free agents, so he would go deeper and deeper into the well and not get as good of players.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the farm system dried up, and it took quite a while to get the Jeters and the Posadas and the Pettits and the Bernie Williams and so forth, and then they had the great run again.
When Billy Martin benched Reggie, I think it was at Fenway.
Well, he didn't bench him. He took him out of the game. He sent Paul Blair out the right field to take his spot.
And Reggie comes into the dugout, and they go at it.
Yeah.
Which is one of the great iconic moments, you know, in Yankee lore.
You know, if it hadn't been for Elson Howard, there would have probably been some punches thrown.
They would, for sure,
he did just a masterful job of stepping between them and talking to Reggie, talking to Billy, talking to Reggie, talking to Billy. And then Reggie goes upstairs, and I followed him up because, and I talked to him. I said, Reggie, you got to get out of here. He said, I'm going to wait till, I said, no, you get dressed, take a shower, and get the heck out of here and go to the hotel and then
right.
settle this thing tomorrow. But no, look, Billy and Reggie just didn't get along.
Do you believe that you learned something from Billy as a manager watching him deal with all of this stuff?
I learned so much from Billy. He was my mentor. He
right.
really was. I mean, when the game started from inning one to inning nine, there wasn't a better guy handling a team. He had a great feel for doing the unexpected, hitting and running or stealing a base. He had a great feel with his pitching, when to pull him. I remember, you know, we talk about pitch counts now. When Guidry was pitching, Guidry struck out a lot of hitters. So he'd ask his pitching coach, Art Fowler, around the seventh inning, how many pitches is Guidry at? He says, oh, he's got 115, Billy. He says, good. When he goes out for the eighth, take about 25 off and start him off at 90.
That's right.
Why do you think pitchers today, I'm sorry, Boom, based on like when you played and your early managerial career, why do you think so many pitchers are having so many arm problems?
You know what? And they pamper them. That's amazing. 100 pitches for a 25-year-old kid that's 6'4", weighs 220 pounds, and he's in great shape. Let the guy pitch. Now, I'm not saying throw 150 or 160 pitches, but you can throw 125 or 130 pitches. Let the hitter let you know when it's time for you as a manager to pull the pitcher. And if he has two or three or four starts, 120, 125 pitches, and you want to shorten him up once or twice with a lead or so forth, you can do that. But I don't like this 100-pitch rule. Look, the Mets have taken care of their young pitching as well as any organization in baseball, right?
And look what's
innings,
happened.
175, low pitch count games, and look what's happened. So what happens, I think these kids work out too much. When I played, and the players of my era, Sparky Lowell, Gossage. Hey, listen, you went home and you had a Jack Daniels during the winter and relaxed, right?
Well, you did.
And you played a little golf and you played maybe a little racquetball, but you didn't throw. You didn't have personal trainers. You didn't have the mass on you. They used to talk about swimmer's muscles, long elongated muscles. That's what you had. And people didn't get hurt anymore. And, the thing I laugh at the most is the oblique muscle. I never knew what the hell an oblique muscle was, and now there's probably seven or eight guys on the big league rosters on the disabled list with obliques.
Hamstrings, obliques, quads, the whole thing.
But unbelievable.
When Noah Syndergaard shows up and they do a whole thing about how he showed up with 20 pounds more of muscle and he looks great and he's throwing the ball 100 miles an hour, Tom House basically told, I think it was Bob Klapisch for NewJersey.com, that guy's going to get hurt.
I'm telling you, midway through the season.
And there goes his lat muscle.
It's amazing. Yeah, too much muscle mass. I mean, these guys are – I mean, they look great in bathing suits on the beach. But you're right. You need 2 or 3 months off. The baseball season is roughly 8 months. And 30 days after the season's over, 15 days after the season's over, they're back in the gym training.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, relax and rest your muscles, rest your body. And you can see that these teams that – play into the World Series like the Cubs and so forth. It happened to us in 78. Pitchers pitch much longer.
Yep.
They get off to slower starts.
The
next year. So you got to rest yourself. That's all there is to it.
I know we got to wrap it up here in a few seconds. Last two, for me at least. What do you miss most about managing baseball?
The competition, the game. The game was the most fun for me. Once the game started, first inning through ninth, you're competing against the other team. You're not really competing against the other manager, but you're trying to outthink them. That's the thing I miss the most. And then the clubhouse with the players, the fun that we had. The media, they treated me fair, but boy, they were tough at times. The travel and the hotels.
I mean, when you pick up second base and you throw it at somebody or throw it into the outfield to kick dirt on an umpire.
The poor umpires. The poor umpires.
You must be a pleasure to play golf with when things don't go your way.
No, I'm actually pretty tame. I've got a 12 handicap, and I play pretty close to it, but I don't work at it. I enjoy smoking or having a nice little Bloody Mary or something on the golf course and having fun.
When someone else writes the book about Lou Piniella, what do you want them to say about you as a player, and what should they say about you as a manager?
Well, look, I was a blue-collar guy. I didn't have a great ability. I really didn't. I played in the minors 5 full seasons. I was the oldest rookie of the year in the American League at age 25. Thank God that Ichiro came around and took that honor away from me. He was 28 or 9 because he had played in Japan. That I was a blue-collar guy that played to win, that enjoyed doing what I was doing, and managing a player's manager, a manager that cared about his players, and that and when the game started, hey, you're out there to kick somebody's butt, win.
You already said?
I heard he said.
So that's what we're going to go
with
tonight.
We have a softball game today. And
there you go.
Boomer's a pain in the ass. He's the manager.
Oh, you're the manager,
the
Boomer.
The expectations he has on a bunch of guys are just having a good time for charity.
I know what happening a good time. We're going there to win.
There you go.
Exactly.
We're walking off the field. We get 3 outs. He goes, losers walk, winners run. You run off the field.
There you go.
Exactly.
I like that. I like that.
Yes.
Well trained.
Don't come
great
tonight.
To see you again, Lou.
Nice seeing you,
and good
Boomer.
Good luck with the book, man.
Thank you so much.
I apologize for adding one extra question, but I'm going to. You and Boomer and a bunch of other guys, the members only shoot.
Yes.
Do you have any memory of Boomer being a little highbrow, pain in the ass, bougie, and hard to work with?
It was a little hard to work with,
that's all.
Yeah, a little bit pampered, you know.
I remember you kept getting in front of the camera that was trying to shoot on me. Yeah, I get it.
Lou Piniella, everybody, check out the book with Bill Madden, 50 Years of Kicking Dirt, Playing
Hard. And Billy
hard.
Did a great job. Great job.
I'm sure they did.
Good friend.
Rider. Winning big in the sweet spot of baseball. It's on sale now. That's Lou Piniella.
And unlike David Ortiz, you don't take shots at anybody, I guess, because the excerpts aren't out there, you know, taking shots at Bobby Valentine and things of that nature.
Exactly.
No, I don't believe in that, truthfully.
There's
enough good things to talk about.
Right, exactly.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.